as introduced, I am Terry Vogt, and I'm pleased to be your moderator this evening for a couple of reasons. One is I was actually raised in Mexico, and I was actually born in Chicago, where my dad had been a rural sociologist during the time that I was conceived and born there. So we will hear from Chad Broughton in a moment. These are the two central parts of what was going on, what is happening in rural the rural Midwest, and what's happening in Mexico. Chad Broughton is a senior lecturer in public policy studies and the faculty director of the Chicago Studies Program at the University of Chicago. He is a member of the American Sociological Association and the Society for the Study of Social Problems. He is the author of the recently released book, Boom, Bust, Exodus, The Rust Belt, The Maquilas, and The Tale of Two Cities. Ladies and gentlemen, here to speak to us about U.S.-Mexico relationship and the true cost of globalization, please join me in welcoming Chad Broughton.
All right. Thank you so much, Terry, and thank you all for coming. So this book, Boom, Bust, Exodus, is a story about what happens to workers and their communities when industries boom and when they bust. And it has a special focus on the last 20 years since NAFTA was implemented in 1994. So some of you may have heard of Austrian-American economist Joseph Schumpeter, who famously described capitalism as the perennial gale of creative destruction, the idea that many are left behind even as the economy progresses forward, right? It's known as Schumpeter's gale. And many have benefited from the creative destruction of the last 20 years in North America, including some of us in this room, perhaps as consumers, investors, and maybe as employees of corporations. But Schumpeter's gale has left many others worse off, or at least in a very different place. These were often the Rust Belt factory workers in industries most caught up in the storm. So, though the subtitle of my book promises a tale of two cities, it actually takes you to three different places, and so will this talk. First, Galesburg, Illinois, a Rust Belt town of about 32,000 that lost its economic anchor, a really huge Maytag appliance factory, in a place where the middle class has... Do you want to adjust that? I don't think I did anything. So Galesburg, a place where the middle class has been hit hard and inequality has been growing around them. Second, Reynosa, Tamaulipas at the U.S.-Mexico border, a bustling city of factories and striving migrants. And then third, the quiet villages of Veracruz in the south of Mexico, where people face hard decisions about whether to stay or to leave, to head north to border cities like Reynosa or Juarez, or further north into the United States. So Galesburg, Reynosa, and Veracruz, rural Veracruz, have become connected in this era of North American economic integration. And the people in these places bear some of the heaviest burdens of economic globalization. And so that's what Boom Bust Exodus tries to do. It tries to take you to these three places and talk about the dilemmas that people face, how they adapt, how they're knocked down, how they pick themselves up. It's a book about human stories, and it's told over time, over the course of a decade. So I'll talk to you about these three places for about 25 minutes. Then we'll have some Q&A. So the book started with a single event in 2002 when Maytag stunned Galesburg with the announcement of this factory closing. And as I mentioned, Galesburg is a small city, about 32,000 people, about 3 hours west of Chicago, and pretty close to the Mississippi River. I had just moved to Galesburg to join the faculty at Knox College, having just finished my PhD in sociology at the University of Chicago. So I grew up in a small town in Indiana, but I didn't really understand what was happening around me in this factory town. I didn't grow up in a factory town. And this small city was not naive to globalization, of course, but they were thunderstruck nonetheless by this announcement. People said it would become a ghost town. People said it would die. There is sadness, there is resentment, there is confusion. So Galesburg was losing its economic anchor, as many Rust Belt towns have. A $60 million payroll, about 2,000 jobs that paid $15 an hour, about twice the minimum wage at the time, and its biggest taxpayer. For example, one couple, Jackie and Shannon Cummings, went from earning $76,000 in today's dollars, adjusted for inflation, to about half of that today, $37,000. They have two adoptive children, and so they've seen a serious decline in their standard of living. They've cut back on vacations, gifts, they have to buy cheaper food now. That's the economic impact, and that's pretty apparent. But there's something else going on in Galesburg, and it seemed to go beyond the lost paychecks. Something greater was at stake, and I wanted to understand what that something greater was. And so I got started on what would become a 12-year research and writing project. I'm a slow worker. So let me start with a story from those early years that I think gets at the heart of what was happening in Galesburg and other industrial towns across Middle America. So a year into my research in 2003, my students and I tagged along with about 150 Maytag workers as they went north to Newton, Iowa, which of course was Maytag's headquarters for so many years. The local machinists union had mounted a fierce media campaign against Maytag and what they saw as corporate greed. A young candidate for Illinois Senate named Barack Obama later joined the machinists as he barnstormed around union halls all across Illinois in his 2004 campaign for Senate. But that morning in 2003, the machinists were there to protest Maytag's decision to close the refrigerator factory. So that morning there were some good speeches and some watery coffee, but what struck me the most about that protest was what the chanters said as they marched around the hotel where the shareholders meeting was. They chanted, USA, USA, USA. They weren't chanting about corporate greed or Mexicans stealing their jobs. It was USA. I was puzzled by this strong display of patriotism at this event, and as I talked to workers, I eventually figured out two things. The first point is rather straightforward. It's depicted in the banners that they had that day and on their t-shirts and on the signs that they had. Maytag, make it in the USA or the USA won't make it. So this is economic nationalism, the idea that you want to keep value creation and good jobs, good middle class jobs in the country to have a good national economy rather than one that promises that wealth will trickle down from the top. But as I began to better understand how these workers saw the world, it became clear that the USA chant went deeper than that. It was about the idea of America, about how Americans ought to treat one another. It was about the social contract between owners and workers. Because generations of Maytag owners, managers, and workers had abided by a set of shared expectations. A set of shared expectations that went beyond the black and white of legal agreements and collective bargaining agreements. Maytag, after all, was a very traditional company, where for over a century, tradition mattered. It reminds me of a scene from that old Western, The Magnificent Seven. Two of the gunslingers in that movie are debating whether they ought to leave the campesino village that they're protecting because they fear they might die if they stay. Chris, the hero, played by Yul Brynner, says, "You forget one thing, we took a contract." He was referring to a simple handshake. His partner, Vin, replies, "Well, I'm not sure it's the kind any court would enforce." And Chris said, "Well, that's just the kind you got to keep." That handshake contract mattered to that cowboy. It was just the kind he had to keep. Now, it may seem naive or quaint to bring up loyalty, commitment, and honor in the context of a global economy. The perennial gales of creative destruction don't shake hands. And work, as we all know, does not involve guarantees these days. But that handshake, symbolizing some sense of mutual obligation, mattered to those people chanting USA. And that old-fashioned stuff, the shared expectations, the sense of mutual obligation, the binding power of social trust, all those things are the threads from which the American social fabric is woven. If everyone is purely looking out for their own interests, the threads come apart and the social fabric rips at the seams. And for those chanting USA, that's what the closing of the Maytag factory meant. To them, Maytag was a quintessential American company, one to be proud of. That it had lost its way was a cause for concern, not just for them, but for the entire country. The Maytag factory closing occurred amid a historic hollowing of America's industrial core. Jackie and Shannon Cummings were but two of 5.8 million people in manufacturing that lost their jobs. We've been talking about deindustrialization and plant closings for decades now, since the 70s, really. But it wasn't until the 2000s that we saw these really historic declines. That's one of every three. We hear a lot about the top 1% getting all the gains of growth these days, right? But this is the other side, downward mobility. The plight of the Cummings family also contributes to growing inequality in the United States. For them, the American dream has been reversed. You know those public opinion polls that ask if the country is going in the right direction? Well, in Galesburg, more and more people were saying, no, we're going in the wrong direction. And chanting USA that morning in 2003 was their warning to the rest of us. So at the rally, there was a sign that said Mexitag, and union leaders spoke of the exploitation of our Mexican brothers and sisters. I soon realized, though, that people at the rally, including myself, didn't have a clue what the working conditions were like at the border, you know, how much people made, why people were there, what this all looked like from their perspective, from their point of view. And I realized that Galesburg, its story was now a transnational story, and that's the only way it made sense to tell it. And so my project expanded, and on five occasions between 2003 and 2013, I went to Reynosa to do research down there. I spoke to Mexican Maytag workers, to economic development people, to government officials, to union leaders, to border scholars, and others. It was great. So Reynosa is a fascinating place. It's a city of about 1 million people, although nobody really knows for sure, at the southern tip of Texas, in case you're not familiar, right across from McAllen and Mission, Texas. So in Galesburg, that Maytag factory was the economic anchor of the community. It's Rock of Gibraltar, right? But in Reynosa, the Maytag factory was but one of over 150 factories in this exploding border city. This is a city where workers in the export factories put in 20 million hours each month. 20 million hours each month. These factories are called maquiladoras or maquilas, and they're everywhere. So here in Reynosa is perhaps NAFTA's biggest boom, all despite the cartel violence, the endemic corruption, and its uneven rewards. So I want to tell you about one of the workers down there named Maria de la Luz Potero. Like so many maquila workers, Maria de la Luz came from El Campo, the countryside, at a very young age to the border. After 13 years at, at 15, she altered her birth certificate to work at General Motors. And after 13 years there at GM, she started to miss work. Terrible headaches and dizziness weren't unusual in a place where, as she put it, the smoke in the air smelled of plastic, or where women whispered about abortos, or miscarriages. She had cancer. She said, I just about went crazy. I got really scared. She went through chemotherapy and radiation as her children, ages 8, 4, and 3 at the time, watched her grow skinny and bald. She was fired from the Maquila for her absences. But what amazes me about her story is that despite all that had happened to her, she still felt blessed to be in Reynosa. When her family from San Luis Potosí would call her from the south and say, "Do you want to come home?" she would say, "No, I'm happy here." Maria de la Luz was cleaning houses when we first met her in 2003, but hoped to return to the Maquilas. The Maquilas, she said, offered something secure and certain. A tiny Christmas bonus, for example, gave her something beyond the money itself, something intangible. Working in the Maquilas meant she wouldn't have to say to her kids, as she had that past Christmas, "Well, sorry, sometimes Santa Claus makes a mistake." The Maquila made her a better mother, and it gave her hope that her life was at least moving in the right direction. She said to us, and I'll never forget this, she said, "Although the work pays poorly, at least there's something for the kids, and we battle." Maria de la Luz was tough as nails, and she battled. She couldn't move up into engineering or management. She was kind of stuck in a dead-end job, like many. But maybe her children, she thought, with better schools at the border, broader job possibilities for women at the border, more chances to learn English at the border, maybe her children could make it up at the border. The massive influx of foreign investment had brought change, for better and for worse, and in heaping doses. Wages have been essentially flat for decades, and many were stuck in dead-end jobs. And Reynosa seemed stuck, too, in a way, in a kind of subservient, low-value role in the new transnational economy. But for many, like Maria de la Luz, it was their best shot. There was something for the kids, and we battle. This raised a third question for me. What exactly is happening in rural Mexico such that Maria de la Luz and hundreds of thousands like her would prefer working for low wages and, in some cases, unsafe environments in a GM or Maquila or a Maytag Maquiladora over staying at home in the South? Which of Schumpeter's gales were raging in Mexico's rural South that would create such displacement? So this question requires some context. Demographers who study migration talk about push and pull factors. Right? And so they would say the border jobs are pull factors, right? Because people come north for the promise of steady work, for hope for their children, for modern comforts, and so on. Like African Americans coming to Chicago or Detroit 50 or 100 years ago, these rural Southerners had come north to their industrial promised land. But they weren't just pulled north, they were pushed out of the South. Nearly all the Maquila workers in Reynosa were from Veracruz, directly south of Reynosa's state of Tamaulipas. When I spoke to them, they spoke about how life in Mexico had gone from difficult to untenable in recent years. They suggested I head south to see where they had come from, to see how Reynosa and Veracruz had become connected in the NAFTA era. So in Veracruz, I spoke to local residents, village mayors, farmers, local politicians, and I learned that just as NAFTA had sped up foreign investment at the border, it had at the same time was part of the wholesale sort of disinvestment from Mexico's countryside, a set of policies pushed by both Mexico City and Washington, D.C., a set of policies that hurt small-scale farmers especially in Mexico. In addition, NAFTA opened the floodgates for cheap U.S. corn and other commodity crops that came crashing into Mexico. And this wreaked havoc on the vulnerable rural economies of the South and contributed to that exodus north on an epic scale. Millions were pushed out of the South. So migration, of course, has many causes. It's complicated. And Mexico to U.S. migration, immigration, is not a new phenomenon. But that push and pull dynamic of the NAFTA era has reshaped Mexico, especially border cities like Reynosa, which have expanded tremendously, and where the infrastructures are strained, and where migrants like Maria de la Luz have found themselves. So it has also changed the United States, of course. Today, the United States has 12 million immigrants from Mexico. No other country in the world has that many immigrants, period. Some Mexican immigrants have even come to Western Illinois near Galesburg, where they bus tables, pick pumpkins, and even carve up hogs in a slaughterhouse near Galesburg. So to understand Reynosa and even to understand what's happening in Western Illinois, it is important to see how things look in Veracruz. And so this brings me to the third and final part of the story, the Exodus story. So imagine a blistering hot summer day in a beautiful Gulf Coast village called Barra de Cazones. It's 2007. These two brothers, Ishmael and Emilio Fuentes, 38 and 40 respectively, are arguing. They've had a few Modelos, and they're having a good conversation that lasted the entire afternoon, and we were lucky to be there to hear it. They're arguing about whether or not it's the right thing to do to leave your hometown in the south of Mexico. Ishmael does. He works as a migrant farm worker for 6 to 9 months of the year and spends the rest of his time in Barra de Cazones, back home. Emilio, on the other hand, has never left Mexico. And so here's an excerpt from the book about their, from their debate. So Ishmael begins. Ishmael. People do not emigrate because they're stupid, Emilio. People who leave Veracruz, they make progress in their lives. Emilio, look, there are two different ambitions. My highest ambition is my family. His highest ambition is money. But with the money he makes, he cannot have the family he wants. If I went to the States and came back once a year, my children could become drug addicts or delinquents. And then he pointed across the table to his well-groomed son, who was, I think, 18 at the time. He wouldn't be talking about going to university right now if I weren't here. Sure, you can see my house is more humble than Ishmael's, but I have family security and Ishmael doesn't. There are two different kinds of ambition. Mine is real and his is a fantasy. But then Emilio looked directly at his brother Ishmael and said, I want to tell you something. The United States is never going to be your country. Ishmael, well, of course not. I love Mexico. Emilio, well, what are you doing for Mexico? Ishmael, I'm not doing it for Mexico. I'm doing it for me. You have to look out for yourself. For God's sakes, Emilio, if you don't go to the richest country in the world, you won't do anything with your life. Emilio, for me, it's just an adventure, a huge land to want to conquer, a land more difficult than your own. With my family, I have a plan for my life. Him? Well, he's not from the U.S., and he's not from here. If I fall, at least I know where I've fallen. And they went on. But so Emilio, and many like him, stay. Just as many in Galesburg, like Jack and Shannon Cummings, have chosen to stick it out in their rural communities with less. But you could see how Emilio was wrestling with his dilemma and wondering what he might be passing up by staying. And these are the kind of tough decisions that I try to look at in the book. Half of the working age population of this little Gulf Coast village had left. And so Emilio is wondering, how long could he hold out? So anyway, those are three glimpses into three places that have been caught up in Schumpeter's perennial gale in the past two decades. The displaced Galesburg workers chanting USA, like Jackie and Shannon Cummings, who wonder if the American dream has reversed direction. Maquila workers like Maria de la Luz in the borderlands working the jobs that Jackie and Shannon Cummings used to have, but at a fraction of the wages, of course, but with the hope that their kids might have something better. And rural Mexicans like Ishmael and Emilio facing life-defining decisions about work, family, and nation amid depopulation and dislocating change in rural areas. So it's of course, this is a centuries old story, but with a new twist. It's a story of the booms of the Industrial Revolution, whether it's in Northern England in the late 1700s, in Chicago in the late 1800s, China of the last couple of decades, right? It's about that mad rush to the newly urbanizing factory-filled cities and the slow decline and displacement of the bust towns, right? The places where Schumpeter's storms have hit the hardest. And all of us really are caught up in these forces swirling around and over us, right? As consumers, we may benefit when we buy the stuff that comes across the border made by maquila workers like Maria de la Luz, right? We may benefit when we buy cheap tomatoes picked by migrant farm workers like Ishmael, or when we buy cheap pork made in America's slaughterhouses, which often profit at the expense of unauthorized Mexican workers. We may also benefit as consumers and investors when a union shop in a Rust Belt town like Galesburg is shuttered, even if Jackie and Shannon have to struggle with less and contribute less economically. I think as global citizens, though, it's essential and maybe even our responsibility to listen to the voices of the people bearing globalization's burdens and to heed the protesters' warning on that day, that maybe the costs of all this creative destruction extend well beyond those most immediately impacted, and that all of this, the erosion of the lower middle class and growing inequality, may be tearing at our social fabric. If we follow this path, the protesters seem to ask, what kind of North America will we be living in another 20 years? A decade after the Maytag shuttering, the relative equality of factory life, where everybody made about the same wage and got about the same benefits, has given way to unequal outcomes. A handful from the factory actually earn more today. They've found jobs at the BNSF Railway, which is, Galesburg is a railroad hub, and railroads have actually benefited from international trade some. But most now get by on less. But the book explores how many have found their niche tending to, you know, patients in the hospital or teaching kids at an elementary school or coaching a junior high basketball team. I quickly understood that former Maytag workers did not want to be viewed as victims. Jackie and Shannon went back to school. They scrimped and saved. They went to yard sales. They scrambled from job to job across the region, but eventually settled near home, even with their incomes halved. As Jackie said, I think we're just little old farm girls at heart. We love apple pie, baseball games. We're just kind of cheesy Midwesterners. I changed too. I didn't write this book with a particular agenda in mind. It started with that closing announcement in 2002, and the journey eventually took me nearly 2,000 miles to the south and lasted over 12 years. But writing the book introduced me to some remarkable people making the best of what they have. To me, it wasn't grim or depressing at all. It was simply about life, and life can be tough. And in fact, I was inspired by the resilience of the people who were doing what needed to be done despite the inequality, despite the unfairness that they saw. Ultimately, then, this is a book about how ordinary people on both sides of the border are surviving this extraordinary storm. Thank you.
Thank you, Chad. I was pleased that the way you went about telling this story, particularly the way that you went to such a real level of sort of personal history, because it really then brings out the suffering that goes on, and the financial suffering on all sides is very large, and it's something that we spoke of just before we came in here, how globalization for many of us is meaning exactly what you mentioned a moment ago, which is our pork's a little bit cheaper. There are a lot of things where things are made in China, and quite frankly, it's cheaper. And also, our pension funds perhaps have been making up the difference of or getting part of that 1% out of the whole thing. Mm. The other thing that I thought was interesting was the I had not understood the impact of the TAA and the question of the funds that the government put forward for the retraining of some of these Galesburg workers. Could you explain a little bit about that?
Sure. So the theory of free trade, as some of you may know, is that the benefits are diffuse, right? They're spread across consumers, and I alluded to that. And we don't really see them, right? And the costs, as I document in this book, are concentrated and noteworthy. But the idea is that from those benefits that come to the consumer and investors, we can provide programs for people who are displaced, right? And then have win-win situations. So they get programs, they retrain, they move on, and consumers get their benefits. And so it's a win-win is the idea. It's obviously, you know, more complicated than that when you actually face a retraining situation midlife, right? It's one thing to be in your 20s, mm-hmm. bouncing around from job to job, finding a place, finding a niche. But it's a whole different thing when you're in your 40s or 50s, like so many of these workers were. And they had jobs, not careers, jobs. And they lost them, their pensions and everything. And so got a mortgage, you got kids. It's a whole different thing. So it had to be kind of a short-term focus. But it was an unusual case with Maytag because, for reasons I can't really go into, workers had 2 years before the actual closing happened, right? And then they had 2 years of unemployment. The TAA benefits, the Trade Adjustment Act benefits, gave them an extra year of unemployment. So they had 4 years to get their selves together. And they also had their education paid for, and you know, even the mileage if they're driving to Western Illinois or something like that. And so people took all kinds of routes. Some people took shorter paths like welding and HVAC and these sorts of things, trade kind of things. And others went into healthcare or education. And about half the people retrained, and about half of those people who retrained ended up in the fields that they retrained in. So there's some, as with anything, there's some success stories where people went on to make $20 an hour as an X-ray technician, and there are others who felt like they wasted a lot of time and also taxpayer dollars. It's just hard to do midlife. Yeah. Really is.
So another, I thought, really vivid portrayal you had was the, it was almost out of reading Forbes or Business Week, your stories of the transformation of Maytag from a company that really created not only a brand, but a great product, and what it ended up as. I mean, it essentially disappeared, right?
Yeah. As I mentioned, it's sort of a quintessential American brand, right? Maytag, it was known for dependability, and workers took pride in that. And they had their, you know, their houses were all filled with Maytag appliances, and they're proud to work there. It wasn't the like most glamorous or enjoyable job in the world, but they're proud of the products they made. But yeah, in Newton, something changed. I interviewed Len Hadley, who was sort of the last great Maytag CEO. He was there starting in the 60s and became CEO in the 90s and kind of saved the company from some problems related to globalization in the 90s and had it at its peak in 1999, in terms of share price and in terms of like quality. They're winning all kinds of quality awards. And then they brought in a couple of CEOs that were called outsiders. You know, it was a very traditional company, and so they always had inside people who knew the ethos, you know, traditional sort of welfare capitalism, take care of the shareholders, but also the customer, workers too, and also the hometown. Newton was always taken care of. But the new people, the outsiders, were more focused on, according to accounts from various people, workers and managers and others, they're more focused on the short term. And that was kind of the moment, the historical moment, too, in the late 90s, if you remember all these news shows that followed every tick of the stock market. Everybody was wondering, like, well, what's it going to do today, you know? And so there was a shift around that time to a more short-term approach. And And the CEOs took it in that direction. And when I interviewed Len Hadley, he said, I was astounded by how quickly the wheels came off the wagon. And, you know, I felt like the board had time to get rid of the second CEO, but and save the company, but he didn't. I can talk forever about that. So don't
you? Well, apparently his package when he sold the company was quite good, as my memory had.
Right. So, you know, people were a little resentful about the fact that they, you know, if they had 25 years, they didn't have a vested pension. And so they're thinking, oh, gosh, I have to find a new job and start all over, and I won't have a retirement. I'll be working until I'm 75 or whatever. And that's happening with a lot of people, of course, these days. And then they see him, who they, from their perspective, had driven the company into the ground and was going away with a $10 to $20 million golden parachute. And it just didn't seem right.
Yeah. So back to the driver here in some respects, which is, as I like this question, why was Bill Clinton and the Clinton administration so pro-NAFTA? And what does Bill Clinton say now about NAFTA? Was it a failure or a success?
I'm tempted to do my imitation, but I'm not going to. I don't know. He said there would be enough middle class jobs created in Mexico that people wouldn't have to come north. That was one of the promises that he and Carlos Salinas, the Mexican president at the time, were pushing on the American people, like, who were very resistant to NAFTA. As many of you remember, I'm sure, there's a lot of contention over this. And this was proposed in part as a solution to the immigration crisis. And as I mentioned in the talk, it actually spiked in its first 10 years immigration north because of the displacement that I talked about. And so I'm not sure what he would say today about it. But, you know, I think part of that was casting himself as a new Democrat, you know, with welfare reform and NAFTA and sort of claiming the middle for Democrats, and he was very effective at doing that.
Mm-hmm. Two of the other actors or characters in your book who really jump out at you are the former priest, Mr. Yeah. Kruger, and then the larger-than-life head of economic development for the sister city across the border from Reynosa, which is McAllen, Texas, named Mike Allen. And I, at the very end, you note about the two of them, how they are remembered or not.
Oh, right, right. I don't want to give away the ending, but yeah, there is. So Mike Allen was this amazing, charismatic figure, and he was a priest at first and worked with farm workers in the '60s, and he told me, and you know, he taught them how to work the welfare system and how to. To get by. But then he switched and became an economic developer. And he really was the driving force behind McAllen and Reynosa's successful growth in the NAFTA era. Reynosa and McAllen were the most successful kind of twin cities at the border in the NAFTA era. Reynosa, I think, had, it's in the book, but doubled the other border cities' growth rates in terms of jobs and value added, I believe it was. And it was because of him. He's this charismatic deal maker. He brought in people from, you know, Germany, from Finland, from Japan, and a lot of investment from America, including Maytag. He convinced Maytag to come down as well. But what he was so good at was he was bicultural. He could go to Mexico City and persuade some politician down there, and then go the next day to Austin, go the next day to Germany, and he was so good at what he did, and that's why it was NAFTA's biggest boom, I think. On the other side was somebody who was also a person who worked kind of in the Catholic social justice sense, Ed Kruger, as you mentioned, and he stuck with it, and he's still doing it. This guy is in his late 70s now, and this is a sweet man. He drives his little Toyota Tercel across the border every day still. Not every day these days, but often. And talks to the promotoras, the grassroots organizers in Reynosa that he tries to bring together. He's trying to work at the grassroots still. He did it for Cesar Chavez in the 60s, and he's doing it in 2015. Mm-hmm. You know, now it's just like, and it's an incredible story. And I just talked to him the other day.
Well, Chad, I know you're a sociologist and not an economist, but a good question from the audience, which is, socially, how easy or difficult would it be for a globalized country to revert back to an isolationist policy or to revert back to the maybe nationalistic? You mm-hmm. mentioned that word in terms of the people on their motorcycles going around
right.
going around the headquarters of or where the shareholders meeting was in Newton, Iowa. And what would be the social effect on the U.S. if it were to become more isolationist or more nationalistic once again?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think the free trade and protectionism debate is not super helpful in terms of understanding the global economy. You know, there's I think all countries engage in strategic trade deals and specific trade actions. For example, Newton, Iowa is actually a great example of this, and see if I can tell Newton, Iowa's story in this context. So Newton, Iowa was, as I mentioned, Maytag's headquarters for over a century, and they had a laundry factory there, big laundry factory. And when Whirlpool bought Maytag, they closed down the headquarters and the factory. And so Newton, this town of 16,000 people, was devastated, probably even more so than Galesburg. And so what happened was local leaders and state leaders in Iowa got together and said, we're going to make Iowa a leader in wind energy production, right? And so they came up with a plan, and they came up with their nodes in Iowa where this was going to happen. And they, they lobbied the federal government to continue the production tax credit for wind power. And so it was a combined federal, state, and local effort. We don't have much industrial policy in this country. Every other advanced economy does have a sort of coherent vision for how we're going to take manufacturing into the future. Well, this at least was a good example of a localized industrial policy at the state level, and it's been very successful. And so how this relates to trade is that China has been dumping, or was a couple years ago, dumping wind towers into the United States. And their government is subsidizing the production of these things, which is an unfair trade practice. And so the United States had been reluctant to take trade action against China, but it eventually stood up and did. And so slapped tariffs on these wind towers to protect this industry. And so it's protectionism, but it's unfair trade practice. So what is it? You know, so it's basically discrete strategic decisions about trade is, I think, a better way to look at it than protectionism, isolation versus free trade.
Yeah. So did this effort taken by Iowa mean that Newton today is a place you would rather live than Galesburg?
Oh, yeah. Good question. It hasn't replaced all the Maytag jobs because it was really a single company town and not diversified at all. But these are decent jobs. They pay over twice the minimum wage. And so at least it has a plan. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, Galesburg, other than the railroad, hasn't really had as much of a plan. I think you need vision, you know, like a big, like exciting idea. And so Walla Walla, Washington is another one where That town was hit hard by free trade, and the community college there and some private interests got together and created a grape growing and winemaking mm-hmm. center. So the community college and private interests got together, and now they have this magnet for tourism. They come and drink wine, and they manufacture, that's actually manufacturing wine. And so that's another example of having a vision for, like, okay, 10 years out, thinking big, what could we do here? And there are other examples like that.
It occurs to me that one last vignette about Newton that I really enjoyed was this fundamental shareholders meeting, which was after the announcement that they were closing down the Galesburg, the one shop town. The chairman of the board tried to sort of cut off discussion, but he really couldn't do it because from the back of the room came a little statement saying, excuse me, I'm the lieutenant governor of the state of Iowa. And yeah. I thought that was a really interesting. Yeah. I apparently went on for an hour or more later, and they yeah. really actually got their grievances out in front of the shareholders.
Yeah. Yeah, that was the one moment where the CEO at the time, Ralph Hake, had to kind of face the music. And, mm-hmm. you know, I think maybe, I don't know his heart, but I think maybe that day mm-hmm. he felt some yeah. remorse. I don't know, you know, what he, how he thought about the, he was very much a kind of a number crunching right. kind of CEO, came from the University of Chicago, actually MBA, and a real cost cutter. That was his strategy. And Len Hadley, the CEO I mentioned earlier, the Maytag guy, said, you know, there's only so much you can do with that strategy. Just like in, you know, creating a vision for a town, you have to have a vision for a corporation too. And Maytag's was always premium products. Mm-hmm. And once you start down the path of trimming back costs left yep. and right, it the ethos, mm-hmm. The magic of Maytag was just yep. gone, I think.
Going back over to the Mexican border, one of the questions from the audience is very good, which is, are there any unions in the Maquiladora areas, and what is the status of the unions? And then I'd like to add, if you could tell us a little bit about this apparent hierarchy that exists in terms of the workers' minds regarding the nationalities of the companies they're working for. So apparently they prefer to work for U.S. companies, followed by European, followed by Japanese, and at the bottom of their list was the South Korean companies. And I didn't really get the full sense of why that was, but it's meshed in some respects with this question about what are worker protections and what does a worker in Mexico get?
Right. Wow. Yeah, great question. So the union, the CETEM, the CTM down there is basically an entity of the federal government, and it's very much oriented towards the status quo. It's not a place, it's not a union that really amplifies the voice of workers as unions are supposed to do. I mean, the union in Galesburg was in many ways an ideal practitioner of local kind of grassroots union democracy. And, you know, I know there are troubles with unions in the United States, but this local seemed to me to do it right. Mm-hmm. In Mexico, it's so much different. The unions basically work for the company as kind of labor relations. And so if you go to your union delegate, they're not going to really do much for you. And that's why Ed Kruger tries to get together the promotoras, these ordinary maquiladora workers, to have some kind of voice together. There are some independent unions that are trying to organize here and there for a more authentic voice for workers and for workers' protections and higher wages. The wages are very low, not enough to support a family. And so we'll see where that goes. There have been some successful efforts by Los Mineros, but in general it's hard at the border for independent unions. Regarding the hierarchy, yeah, that's just what we heard over and over again, that workers preferred to work for American companies, that there's just a little bit closer culturally, even if they're sometimes considered to be, you know, kind of very rigorous in their time management and discipline, especially people that are, you know, coming from the South that are used to the rhythms of the day and the seasons, and that's how the work works in agriculture, right? And so coming to the workshop at the border is a, you know, these very clean, very modern, but you just gotta like relentlessly do these jobs, you know, 8, 10, 12 hours a day, same thing over and over. And all the companies pushed that, but they said this, the South Koreans were the worst. I mean, that's, I'm just reporting what they said, that they were the toughest to work for, and they had the highest turnover as well. So that was a very consistent bit of reporting.
Well, tonight, our president is calling for a fast-track authority to negotiate trade agreements with Asia and Europe. And do you think he should get it, and how should these agreements be crafted? Is there, from the experience we have with NAFTA, is there, has there been any learning? Will it be different?
I don't know. I think in any of these trade deals, it's the devil's in the details, right? And so, I mean, really a free trade agreement could be about this big, right? You can say no tariffs, no quotas, no subsidies, and that's free trade. But it turns out that these deals are actually quite long. And oftentimes, people get their interests sort of written into the deals. And so that's what I would want to know if I were commentating on this, is like, well, who's at the table when these things are actually negotiated? What is the actual implementation of this thing going to look like? And how will that play out? Whose interests are served? So, you know, it would be hard for me to comment on that in the abstract, I think. Yeah.
What about NAFTA's effect on the Mexican small farmer? Could you say a little bit more about the, I guess you call it the push effect in the sense of...
Yeah, the pushed out, right. So it's tough in rural Mexico for small farmers, obviously. So, you know, don't want to romanticize it. But it before NAFTA, and really going back into the 1980s, the rural economies of the South were more supported by the federal government with... a lot of different agencies actually supported them, and food price supports, and support for inputs like fuel and these sorts of things. And those things were taken away, and that's part of the larger push of the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund and the structural adjustment programs of those organizations. And so there's a general, so that the idea among economists is that if you have a lot of people farming in the rural sector, then you're, that's a sign of backwardness. And so you want to urbanize people. You want to, you know, it's going to be tough for that first generation when they move to the cities and they work in the maquilas and they leave their land behind, which they value. But, you know, that's progress. That's the price of progress. But you find a lot of people like Emilio who want to stay, or farmers who want to keep their land. That's their one secure thing, is their piece of social property called the ejido. You know, they're part of an ejido, which is Mexican social property, and they value that and they keep that. And then maybe they farm for part of the year. They do some wage work in a city, and Cancun, or they come north to Reynosa, or do farm work in the United States for a while and come back. But the land is important to them, and they've been forced to come up with different kinds of strategies, these mixed kind of strategies in this era. Yeah.
Well, I also remember how interesting it was that one of the families that you follow from one of the small towns in Veracruz, Laura, her worry is that she has two older kids in Florida, where she first went, and her three daughters with her in Reynosa. And the only good news is that technology has actually got them together today.
Right. Uh-huh. Yeah, so she wanted to, a little spoiler alert, I guess, but anyway, she wanted to rejoin her family. She had her two older children, Jose and Daisy, were in Florida, and she actually has grandkids. Jose has a couple of kids, I think. And so she's never seen them, because when she wanted to take her three daughters across to see the older kids and be all together as one family, including her mother and her father, she got nervous when she got to the border. She didn't trust the smuggler, the coyote. Yeah. And so she ended up stuck in Reynosa, and she's been stuck there ever since. But yeah, as technology has evolved, they've been able to, you know, send blurry kind of pictures back and forth. But you know, this is part of the problem of immigration reform, right? Is that you know, all these families, like Jose's family is a mixed status family. There are so many mixed status families, you know, maybe some in the family are citizens, some not. And so we've created, I think we have to accept that we've created part of this problem ourselves through in U.S. policy, and we have to address it. You know, we've been saying that for a long time, but we really need to, because so many families have been torn apart by this. I mean, when we went down to Veracruz, actually, we talked to a mayor, a local mayor. He put us in the back of his pickup truck and drove us around town, a town called Agua Dulce. And he pointed to all these places where buildings were half built. And he said, you know, that one right there, the father went to the States, the mother went to Reynosa, the two daughters went to Mexico City, and they never finished the home because now the family's been torn apart. And he said, the main job that I have as mayor, 50% of my time is spent adjudicating these property disputes because families have been pushed out of their little towns.
Yeah. I want to mention that I think some very thoughtful questions coming from the audience tonight, and I want to thank you. And here's another one. Will we ever live in a world where borders are obsolete and immigration is rather seen as just a response to market changes and not as something that is seen as invading another country?
Yeah, these are great questions. Yeah. Wow. So the European Union,
absolutely, yeah.
A fundamental right is the movement of persons, and that's in the European Union. They did it a different way, different circumstances, of course, but for them, free trade meant also the free movement of labor, not just capital, not just protecting capital going across the border, but also coming up with a rational plan for the movement of labor, because obviously there's going to be displacement when things change so rapidly. And so that's the contradiction of the NAFTA era, really, is move over here to Reynosa. We'll make sure your capital is protected from Mexican regulations, and the state, the Mexican government, will not take over your business. So we got all that taken care of, but free movement of labor, we'll just like hope yeah. things work out. Right. But of course they didn't. That's the contradiction that we're still dealing with today. And I don't know about the bigger question of whether we'll live in a borderless world, but something to ponder.
But I think the analogy with the European Union works really well.
Yeah,
that's good. Well, I think that concludes our program tonight. And on behalf of the World Affairs Council, I want to ask you to join me in thanking Chad Broughton for this excellent presentation and discussion.
Thank you. Thank you very much.